You're listening to the Lean Built Podcast. I'm Jay.
And I'm Andrew. In this podcast, we discuss our manufacturing companies, lean principles,
and the freedom that we're pursuing in life and business.
So, Jay, vacuum work holding is a thing that we do a lot of, and we had a weird thing happened this week that I have never seen before. And if I didn't have it on video, I wouldn't believe it.
Okay.
So we do a lot of vacuum trimming of our thermoformed plastic parts, whether that's magazine carriers, pistol holsters, knife sheaths, various things. And obviously, vacuum work holding provides excellent vertical pressure, but does not give good resistance to shear. Parts can slip on the fixtures. And a lot of our parts have enough bosses, enough Z-axis features that they locate in place and they don't require tabs to hold them. You can fully trim them out and they just, they self-locate. They can't shift.
Right? You're holding on the smooth side of the Kydex, right?
Yes. So,
yeah.
Yeah. We're always texture side away from the vacuum gaskets.
Right.
But the simpler the shape, magazine carriers have very few positive bosses to locate the parts. And knife sheaths often have none. They're almost completely flat, low Z-axis contour, and they're much more susceptible to sliding on vacuum fixtures. And also, knife sheaths are small enough that we normally don't have good areas around the margins to drop rare earth magnets in. So knife sheaths are, for us, the pinnacle of difficulty of accurate work holding to make sure that we have good trimming, consistent edges on the parts, and we don't have them shear off the vacuum zones.
Really quick, Andrew, give me like a, I'm trying to picture like a vacuum sheath. It's not closed, it's open, it's flat. And so what would the rough XY dimensions be on that
part? We might have a thing that has a vacuum zone that's only 2.25 inches by 3/4 wide. It's a fairly small vacuum zone.
Okay. You said 2.25 by three, what?
By 3/4 inch wide.
Okay.
So like a narrow strip of vacuum zone down the center of the sheath.
102 pounds of downward holding force. Is what the vacuum.
Some of them are even smaller than that.
Yeah.
But that might be an average size.
Right.
And so what we almost always do is there are two main styles of sheaths and holsters, what we would call pancake or taco. A taco is a single piece that is then reheated, usually with a strip heater down the center and folded shut.
Got it.
So it's one continuous piece of material makes both halves of the sheath, both halves of the holster. A pancake is the opposite. You have two independent pieces and they are joined together along all their edges with mechanical fasteners.
Okay.
That can be eyelets, grommets, screws and posts, whatever. But it's two independent pieces and you just bolt them or eyelet them together. The advantages of a taco style sheath are it's more compact. You don't have to have excess material along the second edge to make room for fasteners. You can have the second edge be tight to the shape of your part. The downside is those mechanical fastening points are often their secondary function is to allow you to attach belt clips, belt loops, other things that allow you to actually wear the holster or wear the sheath. So taco sheaths, while they're more space efficient, usually are far more limited in terms of actual mounting options. So we prefer to do pancake style sheaths for all the knife sheaths we currently produce.
Okay.
The challenge there is they're small, they're fairly flat, and they can slip on vacuum zones pretty easily. So we normally machine them in sets of four pieces. So each cycle will give us four individual halves to make two complete sheaths.
Perfect.
And we have to be very, very deliberate about the order of cuts that we make so that the pieces are kept tabbed together for as long as possible. And then only broken free at the very end when all the critical features have already been machined in and all the edges are finished out. And then we're just nibbling off the tabs at the end because we don't want the operator to have to unload parts that are still tabbed and then manually clip those tabs outside the machine. We really want them to come off the machine ready to go.
Yeah. Let me throw in some vacuum work holding theory here. What you're doing is you're using the cumulative surface area of all the adjacent parts to create stability for the specific part you're working on. And you're doing a lot of machining away, but those tabs, the tabs are what, like maybe half inch wide or something like that?
Yeah, we normally do like 0.25, 0.3 inch tabs.
Perfect, yeah. And those are removed last.
Yes.
Which is, then it separates the parts from each other and then the cumulative work holding surface area goes away and then they're held individually. So you want to have your lightest cut at that point.
And we have some parts where in the y-axis, any two parts will self-locate. Mm-hmm. And we have other things where only when all four parts are tied together will they effectively self-locate.
Okay.
So sometimes we use a center star tab where there's a little puck in the middle that tabs out diagonally to all four parts.
Yeah.
And then we clip that out last. In other cases, we can have the y-axis pairs stay as pairs and trim those apart from the other y-axis pair and then have tabs directly in line in the y-axis and clip those out.
Sure.
This particular piece in question had a center star tab. And what happened was we ran 200 parts and a bunch of them came off with one of the tabs not machined away.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we do those tabs to make sure we can clip them off and not have the part shift when we're cutting the tab is we actually make an initial pass that's like 80% through the thickness of the material and like 5 thou offset from the wall. So we take away most of the bulk. We're doing that with an 1/8-inch end mill. We're coming through and just slotting that pre-pass and then coming through with a second tab clearing pass and going all the way down and that extra 5 thou over and just shaving. And we were having one of our four parts from each fixture come off with that tab not pre-cut.
Mm-hmm.
So the tab was still there and the initial pass that would have thinned the tab also had not happened.
Okay.
And that thinning part should happen when the star tab is still in place. So theoretically, the part should not be able to move before the pre-cut pass happens. And our minds were just boggled. Mm-hmm. And so we had already run all the parts. Unfortunately, the operator had not noticed. The tabs are small, but they were enough that they would need to be sanded away or clipped away. They can't just be quickly touched with a deburring wheel. It would involve reshaping the part. So we needed to figure out the problem. It wasn't easily addressed in hand post finishing.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd already run all the parts. So we had to go ahead and reset the machine up for that part, put that fixture back on, call the program, press a few more sample sheets and run it. And what we actually found was happening is the part was shifting slightly out of position. And then when we started our finish pass, the engagement of the cutter was shifting it back into position. So the part was just for a few seconds slipping an 1/8 of an inch down the fixture, not enough to uncover the vacuum zone and break the seal and cause the hold to fail, but enough for it to be out of position for the tab pre-cut to miss that one.
Wow.
And then it would just nick the part and the part would jump back.
Oh, man.
And it was like, I would never have thought that the part could wander not far enough. Because obviously, when you vacuum work hold and you have a shared vacuum for multiple zones, each one holding a single part, if one zone fails, everything fails and your part comes back, your fixture comes back to the door and parts are missing off the fixture. Obviously, something went wrong here. And normally, anytime parts get thrown off a vacuum fixture, they're normally toast. If you're in the cut when the vacuum fixture fails, the chance that it moves and gets tossed off and you don't violate the profile of the part in that little mini collision is almost zero.
Yeah.
But also when you're star tabbing or Y tabbing these things, you can't throw them back on and remachine them.
Sure.
Because once your star tab is partially or fully broken apart, the parts will not have that benefit of co-locating and they just won't work.
Yeah.
So really you get one shot at it. And in this case, what we did with those parts that had gotten missed is we did just manually reshape them. We clipped the remaining tab remnant off with flush nips and then did a little extra finishing step to sand that and blend the surface. And they were all good parts. We didn't actually lose any of them.
Good.
But I'll probably post that video on my Instagram channel this week.
That is so wild.
Because we would never have expected it. We're looking at it and I'm going, I don't see how this could get missed. How one of these four tabs could get missed.
Mm-hmm.
Like if the tool broke and this last tab didn't get cut, that would make sense.
Sure.
But we ran the entire job and we missed this one tab on multiple consecutive parts and the tool is clearly not broken.
Right.
What is going on?
So a few thoughts that jumps out. Number one, thank you for not calling me because we get calls like, hey, I've been doing this thing. It's been fine for 50 cycles. 51, we had a problem, and then 67, we had a problem. your vacuum system isn't working. That's typically how these calls go.
Your vacuum system doesn't suck.
So what I usually say is, okay, well, we've had some success. What things have changed? And people, you know, I'm not trying to put people on the defensive, but you know what? We just need to diagnose it. And so I ask them, is the red button on our vacuum power unit going fully flush? Yes. Great. Is there some type of airflow obstruction to the vacuum power unit? No. Okay. Is there anything else that you can think of? No. Okay. And then I suppose at this point in my career, I've heard so many crazy things that it's hardly ever the fault of the vacuum system that I say, okay, I'm not blaming you. I'm not trying to pawn off liability here, but you have to understand that the geometry, the internal geometry of our vacuum systems are, it's complex, but one of our core tenets is simplicity. There are two moving parts in this entire system, and you can see them both, the red vacuum indicator button and the hand valve that you use to turn it on and off.
Yep.
What can you just put eyes on it for the full cycle? There's a data point missing. We'll go through some of the standard things, the coolant logged chucks. You're cutting dry, so it wouldn't be an issue. But what other factor? Because we got great parts, we got a set of bad parts, we got great parts, another set of bad parts, and now we have a phone call. And by the way, you've owned this for 3 years. It's not our system. There's something else.
Yep.
Yeah, this is a very typical frustrating call. And for us, we care about our customers. One of our other company values is empathy. We're not here to sell products. We're here to solve problems. And if that problem can be solved through the sale of a product, great. It's a win for everyone. I've been in phone calls where I just go, I'm so sorry. I don't know what to tell you. And then a week later, hey, sorry for all that back and forth. We figured it out. So this is one of those cases. That's great though.
So for us, this was a good instance where we could go through a methodical series of checks of the first thing is, if we're getting a cut in a way we don't expect, first of all, is there any junk on the taper of our tool? These machines are run dry. There's no taper wash.
Sure.
Do we have any plastic chips up in the taper that could impact our Z length, that could interact with, change the interaction of the part?
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with partially machining through materials that are only 80 or 90 thou thick.
Mm-hmm.
And so a small change in Z-axis can be a significant percentage of engagement vertically. And the more you thin a part that thin, the more it can flex, the more it can lift, all kinds of things can happen. The margins there are pretty small.
Sure.
Second, is the tool dull? Mm-hmm. Is there, when we're dealing with small, lightweight parts, small changes in the amount of force imparted to the piece can make a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
Is the fixture fully bolted down and flat? Is there any possibility that in loading the fixture on, because we use a subplate with a part-specific vacuum topper on it,
mm-hmm.
do we make sure that everything is down? Are there any possible gaps in the gasket? Is there any place where in loading or unloading, we've shifted or bumped the gasket and we now have a minor separation at a seam? Are any of the gaskets potentially overpacked? Mm-hmm. Which is causing them to ripple or crease or give a spot, which is going to be a little bit of leak. Are any of the through holes potentially partially or fully clogged with a chip?
Uh-huh.
All the things, and just work down the whole list of starting from the part and the tool and the taper, working all the way down, and then saying, can we isolate the problem to a single instance? Is it only happening, since these are twin table machines, we have two systems, two different VPUs and two different pallets in play in any production job?
Mm-hmm.
Is it always happening on table one, or is it only happening on table two, or is it happening in both places?
Mm-hmm.
In which case, could it be a fixture problem? Could it be a VPU problem? Could we have sucked a chip into the VPU that's impacting our airflow? Like, there could be a whole bunch of different things, but being able to go through that really methodically and say, okay, if it's this, we should be seeing this outcome. And if it's not that, it can't be this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what? All those things really useful.
What you're doing there is, which we've started to create a whole library of flow charts, because, you know, me doing this for a long time, all the answers are in my head and I'm going through a mental flow chart. Flow charts are a picture of what's in Jay's mind with his experience. Like, if this happens, then go here. And you ask a series of yes or no questions, kind of like in a Socratic method type of thing,
yeah.
Reaching a conclusion. Wow. Wow. And so you videotaped it, right?
We videoed it.
Videoed it. Yeah.
Yep. I just sent you the video in Signal.
Oh, cool. Okay. I'll check that out. That's so
It's a 3-minute video. I'm going to edit it down and post only the relevant clip.
Perfect.
But it's interesting for you to see how, because we're doing engraving on this part, we're cutting some slots, we're interpolating some holes, we're doing a pre-cut to rough off the material, and then a sectional finish pass where we finish different portions of the edge in certain order to make sure that we are locating, that we're pushing the cutting forces in the direction where the part will locate and not pulling it off away from features that hold it in position.
Great. Yeah, you're doing everything right. Yeah. Hey, can I use this video in a your video in a potential future video? Just even
For sure.
Okay. Yeah. Because that's a great point. Sure. I'm sure we're having a public discussion, but I'm sure this happens weekly in one of the thousands of shops our products are in.
Yeah. And even this kind of thing where there are certain kinds of problems we encounter relatively often. This was a super far out of left field. I've never seen this before.
Yep.
And it was a confluence of a whole bunch of different things. Like we touched off the tool and the tool Z was a little bit off, minor, like a thou or two. There were little edits I made to the program. I think what was happening is we were getting a little bit too much Z engagement and the part was flexing up and the tab was partially breaking through, which was allowing it the part to shift. There were a couple of things going on and it wasn't just cleaning up the fixture or resetting the gaskets. I actually did go back and edit the program a little bit to change that tab pre-cut to make it a little less likely to risk breaking the tab when I didn't intend to.
Okay. Hey, let me ask you this really quick. We have a new product that we released. It's a reverse helix end mill. So it has downward pressure. It's DLC coated, high lubricity. Maybe I can send that to you. Have you, just for testing data, have you ever worked with downcut end mills?
We use downcut for almost everything.
Oh, okay, great.
So we use a lot of Onsrud 64 series. They're super O-flute.
Okay.
Those are our main trimming tools. Generally, we use eighth inch upcut O-flute anytime we're interpolating holes or slotting into the part.
Okay.
And then we use either quarter inch or eighth inch single flute downcut anytime we're doing outside profiling. And we always build into our fixtures lower chip relief.
Like a trough.
Under our cutting edge. So we've got room to push that stuff down.
Yeah, good. Is chip packing an issue? Have you experienced that?
Chip packing can be an issue on certain parts, but normally we just modify the fixture to make sure that the chips don't have space to pack.
So how deep is that trough?
For us, normally not more than 3/16. Even if you're full width slotting with a quarter inch down cut end mill, since we're only machining through 95 or 98 thou thick material, there aren't that many chips.
Okay.
But yes, certainly we will often program, like when we're slotting something, we're ramping into that slot, we will program the Z to come 80 or 90 thou below the bottom plane of the part to create a pocket underneath.
Right.
And then when we first load the fixture in, we'll run the fixture empty. So on the very first pass, we cut in all those troughs.
Sure.
And then we load material on, throw on our vacuum and magnets, and then cut it live.
Okay. Yeah.
So that on our first pass, we're not packing into a trough that doesn't yet exist.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So we only have one of these tools. It's 3/16. I figure people are either using eighth inch or quarter inch, or like you, you're using both. So 3/16 was, I feel like I got lucky there. And then I went
3/16 would do basically anything we want.
Okay. That's good. Yeah. Because so one thing, you know, I've said this publicly a lot, is the enemy of vacuum work holding are side loads from the cutter because it shifts. Yep. Yeah, it's rare to lift apart. It's more common to slide it laterally where you break the vacuum seal. So that's why high lubricity of the coating and also a smaller diameter. If you're snagging your part and pushing it with each turn, each revolution, it's bumping that part over. A smaller diameter has less leverage on it. Some of the most scary cuts that customers take are with shell mills. And I tell them, hey, this is a high risk activity. Here's what you need to do. You need to have work stops on the opposite side of your part. And like, for example, if you have a, let's say a 5x5 inch work piece, it should be located against two pins on the backside of it. So far away from you, your cutter, your face mill should be cutting. It spins clockwise, right? And you start at the bottom right and go from right to left. So those cutting forces are pushing against those pins. Yep. Don't deviate from that, please. And they're like, okay, all right. Well, we were going to, no, you're not going to try anything else. You're pushing against fixed stops. That's it. So
we have our Swift Press, which is a small compact vacuum former we sell to other holster makers.
Right.
We machine it in two ops on a full-size vacuum plate. It's a 15 by 20 by half inch aluminum plate. And we deck the entire thing on both sides with a 3-inch face mill.
Okay.
And we did exactly what you're talking about, which is we have two dowel pins at the left edge in X and two dowel pins at the back Y edge. And then we're finishing front right to back left. So our cutting forces are pushing diagonally into the corner of the pins.
Yep.
And even there though, making sure that our feed rate and our engagement of depth is minimal.
Yeah.
We don't want to be taking off any more than we need to effectively finish out the part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That particular part, we've made it a dozen different ways. I used to make that part way back in the day on two vices with no vacuum work holding at all. And like you over tighten that vice just a tiny bit.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden the middle of your plate potato chips up. Yeah. And you hear your face mill cut getting heavier toward the middle and lighter toward the edges. Mm. And then you flip over to counterface it. And all of a sudden, your part's not a consistent thickness.
Right.
And everything just gets totally goofy. And the number of times that I ended up chasing that around and reposting, go an extra 10 thou, go an extra 20 thou. Mm-hmm. And I had three or four different versions of the facing pass alone saved on our machine because it was such a hassle. And we went to vacuum. I'm like, all right, we're not doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, on the very first pass, we're facing and we're putting in a bunch of holes because we're going to be mounting rubber feet and different things. So on the second pass, when we're counterfacing the bottom side, we have multiple 3/8 dowel pins up into holes in the interior of the part. So we're fully located X and Y. It can't shift. It can't shear.
Mm-hmm.
And so we set it up so that we take a very, very light skim cut on the first side. And if there's any variations in the stock thickness or anything else that would impact, we just flip it over. And then the second pass, second side, much heavier pass going both directions. Don't care about cutter orientation. Just face it.
Yep. You got
it. And that allowed us to get super consistent, always the same, even if we're buying the sheet, the plate from different vendors and its overall fit just comes in slightly different. It's worked out so much better.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
But,
you got it.
But being particular about that face mill, like face milling vacuum held parts.
That's the one thing that keeps me up on that product. So
the same thing though, like face milling parts in a vise, realizing that the direction of the motion of your cutter and the direction of the force that the inserts are imparting are not the same.
Yeah.
Like,
so, okay, this brings up another thing. So every, at least once a quarter, we'll get people say, hey, do you have a cutting force calculator so that I can find out, will this part be effectively held with vacuum? My answer is, I wish I had it, and that calculator cannot exist. It technically could, but there's so many variables that come into play. For example, the easy ones are the number of flutes, the flute angle. How do you qualify the condition of the cutting edge, the lubricity of the coating, the condition of the coating, the hardness of the part? The hardness, it has a tolerance. And sometimes in the middle of the part, it may be softer, in the surface, typically harder. The lubricity of your coolant? So maybe in the morning, you got some sludge at the bottom, or maybe it's a little lean at the top, or vice versa. There's just so many factors. And the other thing, your first part just held fine. You're cutting with coolant. There's a microfilm of coolant between your part and the chuck surface. How do you quantify that? And so, yeah, that's why you can't have a calculator that says you are definitely going to always, with this cut, impart 67.4 pounds of lateral force. It just can't exist. There's too many factors that affect it.
And then all of a sudden you have one piece that's just a little bit oversized.
Yes.
The vendor pre-cut your stock for you.
Exactly.
Brought it all in saw cut to save time. And it's not exactly right.
Yeah. Oh, so this was a neat thing that we discovered this week. So we have a product. I'm pretty sure you own it. No. I don't think it would have worked. The smart plate that sits under your rotary unit.
Don't have that.
Okay. No. So we sell mostly to Haas owners. It allows people to put the rotary unit onto this. It raises it up so you get more swing clearance and then get it outside of the working envelope. The body of the rotary unit sits outside of the working travels of the machine. So good seller. It's a simple product. There is a T-slot that we cut. And actually, we just introduced one for the Brother T200 rotary units that has two T-slots. And we've used a T-slot cutter that is the loudest, most annoying machining sound you've ever heard in your life. It is horrific. Where we typically like my thing is I'm really hoping that these guys run these parts during lunch and break so that the guys are not on the shop floor and they're in our quiet-ish break room, because it's just, you can't stand within 50 feet of this machine.
Ew.
What we tried, different feeds and speeds, different passes, different tools over the years. What we found out was as this T-slotter is cutting through this slot, and it's just 6061 aluminum, because it's an even number of flutes, it's cutting both on the right and the left side of the cutter at the same time. So you are getting this multi-frequency high-pitched squeal, but also this low growl. It's a horrible, horrible screeching sound. And so what we did is we realized that we need to go to an odd number of flutes. I don't want to go up from 4 flutes to 5 flutes because at the end, it's got to do a turnaround. And whenever you're going straight into material and doing like a quick turnaround, it's just, it's also really bad. Like that's the peak pinnacle of discomfort. So I went with a 3 flute. That tool's coming in. We're pretty sure that's going to solve the problem where it's going to cut on the right side. And then at another 120 degree rotation, it's going to cut on the left side. It's going to exit that cut. And then it's going to cut on the right side another 120 degrees. So you won't have this simultaneous like battling of 2 flutes in the cut on both sides of the part. So
yeah, hopefully that's better because those kinds of sounds are just,
ugh. Oh, it is. I almost wanted to record it and post it just for the educational aspect.
It's like when you smell something awful, you're like, oh man, dude, you gotta smell this. Check this out.
Or you smell it again.
Check out this horrible machining sound. If you ever heard something, it's like Dumb and Dumber. You wanna hear the most annoying sound in the world?
That, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
I have, one of my employees says I have ears like a bat. Okay. I often will be in my office with the door closed and I will hear something from across the shop and just come popping out of my office to go see what it was.
Yes. Yeah.
And this week I have gotten caught off guard every time the lathe spools up.
Oh.
It's just a tone and a frequency I'm not used to. And I forget that we have a lathe.
Yeah, right.
And I hear a woo sound happening and I'm like, oh no.
Yeah.
And I come bounding out of my office. And I'm like, is everything okay? And
right.
It's just Chris.
Yeah.
Just proving things out at the lathe.
That's funny.
Like, oh, I have to get used to that being a sound we deal with now.
The Doosans are quiet also.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But even.
But you just still know it.
It's just clearly a different frequency and tone than our brothers.
Yeah.
But even the details of like, I can tell when our coolant is running low on certain machines by how the quiet pump sounds from behind the machine.
Yeah.
I hear a little different frequency. I'm like, oh, we need to check on that. We need to top it up.
Yeah.
And I can tell from the sound of a vacuum system whether I've got no seal, full seal, or partial seal.
Uh-huh.
I can hear it.
Love it.
And the extent to which those things are very hard to describe. I'm not like, oh, it's at 460 hertz. That means it's fully sealed. I'll just walk by and say, that doesn't sound like it's sealing all the way. And we check it and it's like, oh yeah, thread plunger isn't all the way down. What's going on here?
Sure. Yeah. No, that's good. That's experience.
And it's hard to teach.
So we've diagnosed that bearings have gone bad in the live tools in our lathe because we go, I haven't machined since early 2019 or something. Like it's just not what I should be doing. And I walk by and go, that doesn't sound right. And John, you know, my 10-year guy, he'll say, yeah, it's definitely on its last leg. I remember this from years ago when we smoked the bearing. Great. Our motto, just get through this. We'll pull it. We'll service it or we'll send it back. Yeah, absolutely. That's good stuff.
I was listening to Paul Van Meter's Machining Mastery podcast.
Okay.
Machine Shop Mastery with Paul Van Meter.
This is a pro shop guy, right?
This is a pro shop. Yep. Standardizing a shop to huge success with Robert Smith. It was posted on January 3rd.
Mm.
And Robert grew up in a shop. His dad was a machinist and he started doing piecework when he was like 9, 10 years old in their little 40 by 60 shop.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about how much he enjoyed discovering that all the physical motions of loading and unloading a machine were themselves a process that you could optimize.
Yes.
Thinking about where you pre-stage the parts, where you set the wrench, what order you open the vices and remove and replace parts. And that for him as a kid became a game that he would play every time he was loading a machine. He would always be trying to find a way to shave a few seconds here or there. And his dad's shop was primarily working in relatively high volume on forgings, doing post-forging small things like, hey, every single part just gets two tapped holes. Like there's going to be a lot of loading and unloading and not very long cycle times. And Paul's comment was, yeah, that kind of physical optimization is something that certain people get and love and other people are content to just never do. They're just happy to just do it the way they do it.
Yes.
And we see a ton of that in our shop because so many of the things we do are quick and repetitive.
Yeah.
And the difference might only be a few seconds here or there, but it's hugely impactful. We have one thing that we do. We were making some workflow improvements to our packing layout at our shipping station. If we ship 40,000 or 50,000 orders a year and we save 8 to 10 seconds in the packaging workflow, 50,000 times, that's several weeks of full-time labor saved annually. That's unbelievable. Like the law of large numbers is a 2 second savings 100,000 times is 100 plus hours. It's crazy.
Yeah. When you get into those types of volumes, that's where like in machines, when this machine rapids at 1,000 inches a minute and this one does, you know, 1200, depends on the volume. That 1200, that's going to add up.
And for a lot of what we do, a lot of the machining operations we run, the absolute optimization of every single tool path is not critical for us because we're always trying to make a balanced takt time in the cell where we have heating for the plastic, forming time for the plastic, cooling time for the plastic balanced with one CNC cycle.
Yes.
And we're not trying to heat the plastic as quickly as possible and cool the plastic as quickly as possible because the physics of those material changes, you can get additional stresses in your part if you heat it too hot too fast and then blast cool it too fast. There is actually a qualitative difference in allowing it to heat evenly more gradually and then cool evenly more gradually.
That's fascinating.
It's not huge.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
But it makes a difference.
So essentially you're heat treating. It's the same process as metal heat treating.
Yeah.
You heat it up, you cool it up quickly to lock in that structure.
Flexible. You're changing its shape.
Yes.
You're imparting a new structure to it. And then you're cooling it in that new shape. And we've definitely noticed that certain parts, depending on their shape and the contour, if we don't get the heating and cooling process right, they don't reliably vacuum down on a fixture. There's little variations there that are difficult to quantify, but it's clearly a real thing. And so we're never trying to make the CNC machining cycle go as fast as possible.
Right.
We're trying to make it as utterly boringly reliable as we can. And there's usually room in there to do a little extra pre-cut hit there or slow down the lead in so the part doesn't have any chance of flexing or skipping at that point. Doing things that are really organized around optimization for reliability, consistency, quality, rather than optimization for speed. However, if we were doing a job where it's like, yeah, throw this metal part in, drill and tap these 20 holes, and then get it out of the machine as quickly as possible. Like, I normally tap holes on our brother at 1,000 or 1,500 RPM. It'll tap at 6,000 RPM. I just don't like to because my blood pressure doesn't like it. It's so scary to watch what looks like a frighteningly fast, just single shot drill, just like zap into the hole and out. And realize that's a full tap, stop, reverse, and out. And there's always that clunk at the bottom when it locks the spindle and then reverses it. No matter how fast you're going, that always sounds bad. It sounds like a Z-axis bump. Like I just crashed a tool holder into the part, just clunk, 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 clunk in each hole. And that extra little fractional second that I save by tapping at 5 or 6,000 RPM versus 1,500 for little holes in aluminum, it just makes me feel bad. I don't like it.
So like the lean principle there, okay, so we've maybe talked in the past about the process improvement ladder, safety, quality, simplicity, speed in that order. We're always saying, hey, let's make this slower. That's fast, but are we trading speed for safety, quality, or simplicity? Simplicity is the big one because any fool can overcomplicate something, but true genius is taking something and simplifying it and having the same result. I'm not a fan of tapping or really even spinning spindles at their max RPM. For example, our out-of-the-box Haas spindles are max out at 8,100. That's a weird number. We just put them at 8,000. But for example, our UMC, the axis motors are tuned as if it were a super speed machine. the spindle of a super speed mill is 12K. Yeah, that's right. But ours is 8100. But we had the head cover off and we're looking at it and it has the nomenclature labeling that says max RPM 12K. They just slowed our machine down in software and omitted the SS after the UMC 500. And so for us, we just go, oh, yeah, it's fine. These bearings are built for 12K, but we're running them at 8K. But no, especially when it comes to tapping, if you hear a clunk, I don't know, I guess brother could comment if that's okay, but I would not take that risk. I think you're on the
right. Normal. The clunk is not the tap bottoming in the hole. Uh-huh. The clunk is the spindle brake, locking the spindle and then reversing it.
Wow. Okay. Which is, it's literally designed to do?
I think so. We don't do a lot of drilling and tapping on these machines.
Sure.
But I've definitely had some parts, like I made a fixture plate for another company where it had hundreds and hundreds of drilled and tapped holes. Uh-huh. And the difference of going at 1,000 RPM versus 3 or 4,000 RPM when you've got hundreds of holes makes a huge difference in your cycle time.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
I have a friend. He's got a successful shop. He's been around for about 25 plus years. Former Haas employee. Really, really blew it up over the years. And I went to him just asking for, hey, we're starting to machine this material for our new Max 4 pallet system. We're not familiar with it. Can I just pick your brain? I just need a refresher. And it's got tapped holes. And he said, how are you going to tap it? And I said, how should I tap it? And he said, thread mill. We don't do thread milling. We only do thread milling in our smart plate for the half 13 because it's a gnarly. It's a big diameter tap.
Yep.
And so we thread mill. It's beautiful. Oh, and it also gets anodized. So there's a hard anodized. So hard anodized and threads can be a really big issue.
Uh-huh.
So we like to control that pretty closely. But he said, no, we hardly ever tap. And I said, we roll form a lot, pretty much 100%. And he said, yeah, but that's fine. But we just found that we'd rather spend a little extra time and thread mill and accurately control every diameter of hole that we tap. And so we're starting to move over all of our NPT tapped holes.
Yep.
With using an NPT tap because it's beautiful. I mean, because we usually, like the numbers in my head, we usually have to drill with a 339 drill to a depth of about 600. And then we have 400 worth of thread with a tap that out of the box, we grind about, I don't know, like 200 thousandths off the tip. So we get more engagement because remember, it's tapered. Now we just drill to about 450 and then bring that tap, that thread mill, down to 400 and then just spiral out and then check it with a thread gauge. And it is beautiful. I'm going, why did we not do this 10 years ago?
So one of the scariest tapping moments I've ever had on that exact same 15 by 20 by half inch plate, It has a center NPT threaded hole in it for the main fitting that connects it to the vacuum pump.
Got it. Yeah.
And I don't recall off the top of my head, I think it might be a 3/4 NPT. It's a fairly large thing.
Yeah.
And when I first started making that part back in 2015, I was scared to learn programming thread milling.
Right.
I didn't really know how to do it. And NPT was tapered. I wasn't sure how to do all that. So I was rigid tapping with a cut tap in a BT30 with this big tap.
Wow.
And it would always squeal on the way in.
Yeah.
And one time I screwed up the vise setup and I pulled the entire plate out of both vices on the tap and started spinning it in the machine.
Oh, man.
And that was like, that was one of the absolute worst feelings. I was like, and it just came up off both vices.
Oh.
And then this huge plate is dangling from my spindle, spinning. And I e-stopped and I'm standing there going, how do I even get this out of here? Like, I had to index the spindle and lock it with an M19 and then hand turn this plate backwards off the tap.
And it's a 15 by 20, right?
It's a decent sized plate.
Oh, man.
And at that point, I'm like, all right, it's time to learn the treadmill. And so I just put a bunch of blocks of plastic in a vise and practiced, just messed around with programming treadmills to figure out how many passes I wanted and how much engagement I wanted and everything until I could get the exact fittings that I needed for that part. To thread exactly the depth I wanted in that part.
Wow.
And from there, it's been phenomenal. Made that part safer, faster, easier.
Yeah.
And now that we're vacuum holding it, I probably could go back if I wanted to rigid tapping it and not have a problem because I'm going to have downward holding force right there where I'm tapping.
At greater holding force. Yeah.
But the sound of that big tap just squealing into the part.
Nah.
Not so, a fan. Zero out of 10. Do not recommend.
I got another great tapping horror story. I used to have a Haas TM3P. I bought that because, okay, so if you look at our offerings of our vacuum chuck sizes, our smallest is our 9.5 by 14. And the reason is I made that on my Haas mini mill that had, what was it, 12 by 16 inch travel. So it's pretty much like the largest part you could machine.
Yep.
So then I bought a Haas TM3P, which had the same travels as a VF3. So it was 20 by, I want to say 40. And then that allowed us to move up to our 13.5 inch wide vacuum chucks deep. One time, our vacuum chucks have 9 1024 tapped holes in the vacuum area. And in the corners, it has 4 1/4 20 STI screw thread insert taps. The machine was great. Made lots of money with it. No problems. Was it slow? Yes. Was it not rigid? It was not rigid.
Also, yes.
But it was doing very light machining to make our vacuum chucks. A lot of hogging on the bottom, but it was fine. Just a, 7.5 horsepower spindle. It's fine. But one time we were tapping and we thread rolling. What are the other express tap?
Form tapping?
Yeah. So it doesn't create a chip, which is great. Yep. It's a wonderful way to do it if you're scared of chips or chip packing. At some point, it's threading down, it reverses, and it's coming out of the hole. And I hear this 7.5 horsepower spindle that, what was the max RPM? 6,000 RPM on that? Come to an ear-piercing roar, like, rah! I whip around, I look, and the spindle is moving. It's at this point, it's probably a good like 8 to 10 inches above the part. It's only supposed to retract to about 200 thou and go to the next hole. What had happened? There was some type of glitch in software or some like micro brownout, but it was reversing the thread. And as it was accelerating, I think it reads the speed of the spindle and that causes it translates that to the speed at which it should move the Z up.
I think
that's how it works.
Synchronizing.
Yes. It was accelerating and it did not stop accelerating. So when I went, what in the world? It's 10 inches above the part. I look over at the spindle RPM meter and it was in the 40,000 RPM range. And the only reason it stopped is because it hit the Z limit switch that was a solid 16, 18 inches above the part, at which it hit it and the machine just like went into an e-stop mode, an alarm mode. And I was so freaked out that I just ran over and I just hit the power off button. I don't know why I did that. And the spindle just never decelerated. And when you hit power off on a machine and the spindle is turning, it doesn't decelerate the spindle. So we sat there for something like close to like 3 to 5 to 10 minutes waiting for the spindle to decelerate back to its stop point of where it would stop. Cause I just hit power off and I just went, I don't know what happened. That's one of the scariest things of the past 5 years that's ever happened. We turned it on. It was fine. That machine required you to manually grease. It had grease fittings for the axes and I think for the spindle. I shot in a bunch of grease and turned it back on and just made parts for another 2 or 3 years. But yeah, that was crazy. That was the craziest glitch on a quote unquote safe tapping cycle.
Yeah.
So that was not on us.
Yeah. Tapping.
Yeah. It's scary.
But I need to hop off.
Sure.
And it's great to talk to you. I will have hopefully more updates next time about actual production jobs running on the lathe. And I have some things I want to talk to you about real estate, either adding on to or building a new building and thinking 5 to 10 years down the road about the life of the company and what we want in terms of access to space, parking, power, ceiling heights, a whole bunch of stuff.
Love it.
Because we are filling up our current building and I don't think we're nearly done growing.
Isn't that amazing?
We've got available property. Mm-hmm. And we need to figure out now what is going to be not necessarily the easiest path, but the greatest value payoff, both in space and capability for us, but also financially down the road. I have no interest in retiring as a landlord, But certainly I've loved owning my own shop, just the freedom of being able to modify anything I want.
Oh, yeah.
Expand the parking lot, expand the parking 100%. Lot. Change the power around.
Absolutely.
Do this or that.
Yep.
Renovate the bathrooms, repaint the offices, tear that out, put that in.
Yeah. Greatest
not
benefit.
Not anybody else's permission.
Yeah.
Huge.
Love it.
So freedom, I don't have any interest ever in moving someplace where I have to return to leasing.
Uh-huh.
And using the space that we have, the available land we have behind our current shop to build a building that's going to best balance our short-term needs, mm-hmm. our long-term growth potential, and give us avenues to potentially sublet.
Yep.
So that we can have a second income stream there and then have ready-made space to move into,
mm-hmm.
already built over time as we grow.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of things to balance there, but I have a lot of ideas and I have a lot of questions.
Mm. I'm looking forward to that conversation. It's right up my alley.
Great. Thank you so much, Jay.
All right.
Have a great day.
See you next time.
Bye.